This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
One of the things that we do learn from human nature is the fact that people are shaped by recent events. After all, human lifespans aren't exactly that long, and there are metacycles that go longer than human lifespan, and there you have to rely upon history. But somehow history always tends to get a little bit blurry, and it doesn't quite affect people as impactfully. For example, if you didn't live through December 7th, 1941, maybe we know that was the day that was supposed to live in infamy, according to President Roosevelt, and we do remember it, but it may not have the same impact if you live through it. Here we are, look at the Kennedy assassination. And I remember where I was that day and how it impacted me. It just is permanently etched in your mind. But my kids don't have the same memory of that. You know, I noticed, Jim, you've commented that the public is not participating in this bull market. As a matter of fact, Ralph Ancobor, the technician on this week's show, said the same thing today. This a lot of times reminds me of how my parents' generation was shaped by the Great Depression and by the Second World War. And one observation in talking with them frequently about this that I've noticed is, A, they know how they survived and got through the Depression. They can tell you very well about that. But B, when you ask them what caused it, they don't seem to understand that. Even to this day, do they understand all of the mechanisms of exactly how we got into the Great Depression. And if we look at it, if we jump forward, you can almost say the same thing about the boomers and then Gen Xers as well, who have been traumatized by the events of the last decade or so. First of all, the tech market bubble popped. That was a little more than a decade ago, although they didn't admit that. They tried to offload that onto the next traumatic event, which really was 9-1-1. That is one of those events that lives in your mind if you live through it. There was the second Gulf War, the Afghanistan War. Then we had Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Then the real estate bubble went kaplooey, and following right on the heels of that was another market crash. And now we have these just trillion-dollar deficits. Of course, those didn't happen overnight. So to a large degree, the people participating in the market is not generally the public. You have people coming to you saying, what should I do with my money? I don't know. And they're just worried as heck that we're going to go through this again.
You're right. And we tend to look at recent events. It's kind of like that old saying, the general's fighting the last war, John. And if you take a look at the boomers, like you and myself, we started out our careers during the great bull market of the 80s and 90s. I mean, gosh, every single year in the 80s, the stock market went up. But if you were in bonds, you were getting double-digit returns, and they were guaranteed. Heck, you were getting 12, 14% at the bank. You were getting toasters. And then in the 90s, when Greenspan brought interest rates down, well, then the stock market was going up double digits. And you're right. We did start the beginning of the last decade and the new century with a crash and the technology bubble, but right on its heels began a new bull market and a bull market in real estate. So most boomers have experienced the booms of the 80s and 90s in the last decade, but more recently they've been shaped by, I would say, the tech bubble was quickly replaced by another stock market and, more importantly, a real estate bubble, which had a greater influence in terms of consumption and the amount of debt that people took on. But I believe what really has shaped investors' minds has been the fact that we got a second bear market in a decade. Now, remember, in the 80s and 90s, we didn't have a bear market. In fact, in the 80s and 90s, we went a whole decade without a recession. We had a recession in 81, didn't have another one till 91, and then not another one until 2001. But if you look at the last, 13 years, it was two bear markets. And those bear markets saw stocks decline like the S&P 40 to 50%. In addition, for the first time in almost half a century, or probably going back to the Great Depression, John, most Americans' largest asset is their home, and home prices fell 30 to 40%. You know, people that were counting on, gosh, I have all this equity in my home. They were taking out home equity loans. They were borrowing against it, thinking the fact that real estate would never go down. And when it came to retirement, they would just cash in on this big equity they had built up in their home. Well, housing prices fell. And once again, we hadn't seen that since the Great Depression. So this definitely, I think, has shaped a lot of investors' minds and why we get such, I would say, negative feedback on, no, things can't be this good, or the market shouldn't be going up, or the government shouldn't be doing this, and gosh, corporations aren't doing this, or I just don't believe it. I don't trust it. And so you're right. All these events, 9/11, first time we've been attacked on our own shore since Pearl Harbor, two bear markets, a crash in the real estate market, companies going under, getting bailed out by the government, $1 trillion deficits, quantitative easing. I mean, this was stuff we used to talk about that was in Japan. We never thought we'd see it here, that we'd see 0% interest rates, but that's where we are.
Well, the challenge, I think, now is overcoming these negative thought processes, which I guess you could sum up in word trepidation, caused by these events, especially if you look at the baby boomers. And I remember in the 80s, because my dad had set aside a lot of money for my mom, invested in those very instruments, and they were all doing pretty well at the time of my dad's passing. But as boomers now try to retire, or are coming close to that, to be followed very closely by the Gen Xers, and they're discovering they just don't have what they thought they were going to have.
Well, I think, you know, the one thing that you have to overcome pessimism, and especially when you go through a traumatic event, is you got to face those fears. And one of the ways that you can do that is by reading opposing points of view and start educating yourself, because one of the greatest ways to overcome something is to face it. And you can do that through the process of education. The more you learn about the markets, the more you learn about companies, the more you learn about monetary policy and begin to understand it, then the more comfortable you're going to feel when you have to make those decisions. So in other words, you're going to become informed. And what I find one of the biggest mistakes, and quite honestly, I was guilty of this in my own career earlier on, is most people, John, tend to go to the same sources of information. And especially if these people have kept themselves in a bunker, they keep reading the same websites, the same newsletter writers, they go to these prophets of doom. I remember when I first got in the business, just about every book that was out there at the beginning of the 80s, How to Profit During the Coming Collapse, How to Profit During the Bad Times, Howard Ruff, all these books that were coming out telling people about all these awful things that were going to happen just as we were beginning one of the greatest bull markets of the 20th century. And it's what dominated the bestseller list. And if you look at what's happened since 2007 and 2009, go to the financial section of the bookstore at Barnes & Noble and take a look at all the books. The coming crash, the dollar collapse. I mean, it's all gloom and doom stuff, just as we were beginning another bull market. So if you keep going to the same websites, reading the same information, the same newsletters, you know what? It's going to do nothing but reinforce that same feeling that you have. Rather than maybe dealing with the cognitive dissonance that you have inside your mind, well, these guys keep telling me all these awful things are going to happen, but I turn on the evening news and the stock market just hit a new record. So what happens is if you keep going to these same sources of information, number one, you need to ask yourself, wait a minute, they've been predicting the end of the world and they've been doing it for 6 years and it hasn't happened. But what it does is it reinforces a negative feedback loop. And that's why we try to get opposing views on the program, and especially with people I don't necessarily agree with. But we want you to at least hear the other side of that story. And the one thing I would encourage you to do is what I do, which is read opposing points of view. I get a lot of newsletters I don't necessarily agree with the authors of those newsletters. I get some research I don't necessarily agree with. But I like to read it because I may pick up an idea, or it may bring up a point. Boy, you know, I'm going to bury that in the back of my mind and watch out if something like this happens. It'll alert me to something. So what it does, it broadens your investment scope, and it also teaches you to be a sharper investor. You get more inquisitive. If somebody says, gosh, get out of stocks right now, it's going to crash. I can't tell you the number of doom sites that are out there have been calling for crashes every time we've had a market correction this year. And here we are sitting at new record levels. It's one of the first times that we've barreled through several century marks in the S&P alone. We start out below 1,500, 1,600, 1,700. And on the day that we're doing this show, we're close to 1,800.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that it tends to reinforce is the sense among the public that there is an at-wrongedness. In other words, you're hearing things like the economy is recovering and Wall Street's doing well, but people are out of jobs and they can't understand this disconnect out there, which leads to a lot more political tension. But one of the keys to dealing with all of this is, I think, becoming informed as to exactly what's going on, because that takes out some of the mystery from this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we did a recent interview with Dr. Gary Schilling, and Schilling, you know, he sort of looks at bigger picture, and he was very influential in my career. I got in this business, John, when we were coming to the end of an inflationary era. Volcker was heading the Fed. Reagan was coming in as president. All the gloom and doom books were out there, but Gary Schilling wrote a book in 1982 called Deflation, Ready or Not. And when I read that book, I said, you know what? This makes a lot of sense. And it's lining up with what I was starting to see in the investment markets, and it changed a lot of the way I looked at things. And instead of gravitating towards the gloom and doom books that were so prevalent at that time, you know, after reading Schilling, I started reading more positive things and got on board the new bull market. And Gary Schilling has been bearish. He's been more closer to the disinflationary camp, but he put out a piece a while back, and I had him on the Premium Channel lately, and he talked about Advantage America. Now, here was a guy that was negative. Now, he was negative early before 2007. To his credit, he was early. But the things he talked about happened. And he's been a little bit more on the bearish side longer than maybe he should have been. But you know what? He's smart enough to know that things change. And he wrote a recent piece called Advantage America. And for those of you that are in the Premium Channel, you probably listened to some of the things he laid out. Our demographics are probably some of the best in the developed world is an advantage. We have greater flexibility when it comes to labor compared to, let's say, countries like Japan or Europe. We have declining deficits. Now, how long they decline, we don't know, but we're not running trillion-dollar budget deficits, and we're not running $600 and $700 billion trade deficits. We also have an entrepreneurial spirit. Think of social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, all these companies. You know what? They began here. And contrary to the imminent predictions of a dollar collapse, I've been hearing that for, gosh, the last 10, 15 years, it hasn't happened. The dollar has gotten stronger. Look what's happening in energy. I just did an interview with Kurt Schaefer, who follows the energy industry. And just as you've heard about horizontal drilling and fracking, companies like EOG and Whiting Petroleum have just invented another form of fracking that is not only producing higher output in a well once the well is drilled, but also prolonging the length of the well. So the energy revolution, and John, probably one I would add on top of that is the manufacturing renaissance. And another one that I would add is Meredith Whitney's thesis about the Central Corridor is really the new emerging market in the United States. So there are so many, when you add all this up, yes, there's negative stuff. I don't want to be a Pollyanna, but there are more things that are right about America than those that are wrong. And even though economic growth has been, let's say, below normal, unemployment still remains high. John, I think much of this has to do with the Obama administration's bad fiscal policy. There was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal today talking about, you know, the voting down of Keystone Pipeline. That would have created over 20,000 jobs, 2,000-page Obamacare, all the uncertainties which we're just now beginning to find out. Dodd-Frank, the EPA going after businesses and utilities, tax hikes, all of these things, and not to mention the fact that there's been no budget in this administration for 5 years. So some of this is weighing on the economy, but the thing that makes this country great and why we're doing better than, let's say, Europe or Japan is that America is still a private sector economy. And despite all these efforts, the stock market is up over 150%. Our economy is still growing at 2%, but you remember, we still have the largest economy in the world, and a 2% growth rate is much different than a 5 or 6% growth rate in a country like China. And you know what? Everybody talks about our deficits. They're coming down. But if Japan has a debt-to-GDP ratio of 250%, ours is more like 100, we got a long ways to go before we get into any major problems like what we've seen happen in Japan and Europe. Are they great? No. But are they bad that you want to stay in a bunker Absolutely not.
Well, so far, Jim, you've maintained a lot of optimism about the stock market going higher. But as you well know, the things go up to a peak like a roller coaster and they come down. Don't you ever worry about another crash? How often do these things happen?
Well, I mean, for reasons already mentioned, I think, John, we're going to see the market melt up into the end of the year. Now, Ralph Ancampora said, as he did in the first hour, he goes, it's the things he doesn't see is what makes him optimistic. And the things he doesn't see are no signs of deterioration at this time in, let's say, selling or divergences. Now, next year, if we keep running at the rate that we're doing now, now remember, the gains this year is coming on top of double-digit gains last year. So at some point next year, as Ralph talked about, and I agree with him 100%, that we're going to have a significant correction. Maybe we get our first 10% correction. And it'll probably begin, John, with the Fed beginning to taper. And we'll do a show next week on that because there's some misinterpretations in terms of the Fed minutes. They're also getting ready to goose the credit markets, and nobody picked up on this thought, but we don't have time to pick up on this in today's show. But at some point, whether it's taper or Washington does something stupid, which, you know, you can't put that one aside because they tend to do stupid things. But that will give us our first serious correction, but that's all it's going to be. It's going to be a correction in an ongoing market. I have heard time after time after time over the last 5 or 6 years, every time there's a little crisis, there's a headline, whether it's Fukushima, Arab Spring, debt ceiling debate, the fiscal cliff, whatever it is, and we had a number of those coming in after summer recess, that all these imminent predictions of a dollar collapse and a market crash, I just do not see it. I don't buy that argument.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about us being in a bubble, but based on what you're saying, I'm going to guess that you don't believe that.
No, I don't buy the story of a bubble. Bubbles don't happen when everybody is talking about them. Did you ever hear very many people talking about a bubble in the year 1999, 2000? No, they were talking about the new economy. They happen, John, when things are actually very, very good. Everybody thinks they're going to go on forever. Think about, you know, 1999 and 2000. We had overcome the business cycle. We were in a new economy. All those kind of things. The markets were going up double digit. The unemployment rate was the lowest it's been. Economic growth was 4% and 5%. And it was just, everybody was euphoric. We were all going to get rich by investing in technology. And if you look at the three phases of any bull market, John, they always begin, the first phase after a bear market is disbelief. And we've had a lot of disbelief. I mean, just, you know, if you're listening to this program, think of all the calls, emails that we've had here on the program about disbelief. They enter the second phase, which is where I think we're at right now or heading into, which is acceptance. And the time you begin to worry about bubbles is in the euphoria phase. That's when everybody's all in. Things look just incredible in the economy. The economy's growing. The unemployment rate's down. Every time you turn on the evening news, there's just nothing but good stories out there. The market is going up. People are getting wealthy. That's the time you want to be worried, is when things really get good on Main Street. That will be the time you know you're coming to the end. But boy, I tell you, you take a look at that. We're far from that point at this point. This market has a long ways to go. You know, Dow 20,000 is not out of the realm. Also, when things get good on Main Street, I can bet you this, the Fed will begin to tighten, and that is the time to start taking profits. But John, we may not get there until maybe late 2016, 2017.
I think we need to boil this down to pragmaticum here. What kind of advice would you give listeners, assuming that everything you're saying is correct?
You know, it's time to turn on the lights and come out of your bunker. You know, it isn't the best of times, but no bull market begins when times are good. They end when times are good. But it's not the worst of times. And what the market is focusing on, basically the market is asking one question. Are things improving at the margin, or are they getting worse at the margin? And from my perch, John, when I look around the globe, look at the LEIs that are ticking up, I look at the disinflationary trends in the developed markets and the economic fundamentals, this is as good as it gets. It tells me the place to be is invested in stocks. And despite the media headlines, when have these guys ever been right? Balance what you hear from gloom and doom with what is actually happening. and take a look at all those positive things that Schilling was talking about that are happening in this country. Whether you're looking at the demographics, labor flexibility, declining deficits, our entrepreneurial spirit, the dollar getting stronger. I hate to tell you, folks, if you think it's going to crash, it's not. Our energy revolution, our manufacturing revolution. If you don't move out of your bunker, quite honestly, you're going to be left behind. You aren't going to reach your retirement goals, or if you are retired, your retirement is not going to be what you expect it to be.
But I think we could still sort of sum it all up. Right now, there are more things right with the U.S. economy than wrong, and you can make the right moves as long as you understand what's happening.
Absolutely. John, I just want to end on this. Look, if you've been in the bunker, you've been in there too long. It's time to come out. And if you're frightened about this market, you know, take a look at, start educating yourself, start reading opposing points of view, and start questioning the advice that you've been given. If the crash hasn't occurred and they've been telling you it's going to occur every single year, you should begin to question that point. If they've been telling you to short the market, get out of stocks, and just hold gold or cash, you need to question that view. Has that been the right view? One of the biggest trades this year has been long the stock market, short gold. I bet you're not hearing that from the doomers.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. And Brian Pretty did an interview together where you opined about Warren Buffett's strategy regarding the purchase of ExxonMobil. What we're going to do in this segment of The Big Picture is to delve into that just a little more deeply. And in doing a deep delve, we'll see how you could apply that model and that strategy to your own investment.
You know, when the announcement came, John, when Buffett bought ExxonMobil, I thought, and in a significant share, by the way, I mean, the stock's at, $95 on the day we're talking. And here's a guy that bought 40 million shares of Exxon. So this was no small purchase, and it represented probably one of the largest purchases of a publicly traded company that Buffett has made since maybe, his purchase of Wells Fargo. So when I started to look at ExxonMobil, which, you know, I need to disclose, it's one of the stocks I personally own. So let me get that out there. But then I began to look at it from what would Warren Buffett see in ExxonMobil that would cause him to, let's say, buy or take a stake of over 40 million shares. Well, if you take a look, if you studied Warren Buffett's philosophy, as you know, he likes buying companies that have what he calls a protective moat, some kind of business monopoly or something that protects the business from competition. Well, item number one on Buffett's list, protective moat. Does Exxon have that? Absolutely. And that protective moat would be barrier to entry. It costs billions of dollars of money to get into the oil business. I mean, just think of what it costs to buy a lease on a property, buy land, get a drill rig, poke a hole in the ground, the personnel that you have to hire, all the materials used, still well casings. I mean, being in the oil business is a very capital intensive business. So not everybody can start an oil company. So point number one, you have a protective moat or barrier to entry. Point number two, because Buffett recognizes the long-term effects of inflation, is he looks at stocks as businesses. And what he looks at in a business is what are they earning on stockholder capital, or what we call return on equity. And one of his minimums is 15%. The return on equity in Exxon is 28%, and it's been fairly consistent. In fact, Exxon has probably one of the best returns and is one of the best capital allocators in the resource business. Very few, John, oil companies, mining companies, commodity companies, iron ore companies, whenever you look at the sector, very seldom do you see companies that have consistently earned double-digit returns on capital. A second thing that Buffett always looks at, because he runs an insurance company, he's always looking at companies that generate large free cash flow. Free cash flow is the money a business has after it pays for all of its expenses, pays out its dividends, invest in new plant and equipment to keep the business modernized. And ExxonMobil, we'll get to in a second, has literally billions of dollars of free cash flow. Because from that free cash flow, they can do a number of things. They can increase the dividend, pay out a dividend, or they can buy back their stock or invest in new businesses. Which brings us to the fourth criteria, and that is buying back stock. And Exxon, in addition to paying out double-digit increases in dividends, has been retiring a significant amount of its stock. It's gone from 5.8 billion shares outstanding to 4.5. So when you add all those up, now you look at, okay, they meet his criteria. Another thing, the stock market is selling at 16 times earnings. That's 2013 earnings. Exxon has a PE of 12. The dividend yield on the S&P is about 2%. Exxon's 2.7%. And here's the more outstanding thing when you look at this company. Exxon is generating almost $48 billion of cash from operations. Their earnings are $34 billion. They spend $10.7 billion on dividends. So they're basically paying out about a third of what they earn in dividends. So what is Exxon doing with all that cash? Well, number one, they pay a nice dividend. Number two, they've been increasing the payment of that dividend by 13% a year. That's significant. Over the last 3 years, if you take a look at the last 5 years, they've been increasing the dividend at 10% a year. So if you look at this from the beginning, this is really, you know, Buffett's criteria: protective moat, high return on equity, high free cash flow, buying back stock, reasonable valuation. And now you understand why Warren Buffett bought ExxonMobil.
You know, Jim, this would seem to be a no-brainer, because from this type of a source, you're going to have predictable income. That's the big thing. It's predictable in terms of being a long-term investment. Obviously, oil isn't going away at any time in the near future. And bond rating-wise, well, it's better than the U.S. government, which I guess we say tongue-in-cheek anyway, right?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's what made Buffett one of the richest men in the world. Buffett looks at stocks with dividends as high-quality bonds. The only difference is, unlike a bond that has a frozen interest rate, he looks at them as a bond with a growing income stream. I mean, let's take a look at this if you're a Warren Buffett. Your business is generating billions and billions of dollars of free cash flow. So you can take that money as an insurance company. You need to invest it. You can look at treasury yields. I can buy a 10-year treasury note at 2.7%, or I can invest in Exxon and get the same return, a 2.7% return. So 2.7% on a treasury, 2.7% on Exxon. Now, here's the problem. 10 years from now, in the year 2023, the 2.7% that I'm earning on my treasury note is still going to be the same. In the year 2023, I will get 2.7% if I hold that treasury note to maturity. On the other hand, if I take a look at ExxonMobil and just take a look, Exxon has been increasing its dividend at 13% a year over the last 3 years, and they're able to do that because they're retiring more and more of their stock, which means more of that cash flow gets distributed over fewer shareholders. So let's just be conservative and say that Exxon increases its dividend at 10% a year. 10 years from now, the yield on Exxon, assuming the stock price doesn't go anywhere, is going to be 7% versus the same yield on a treasury note, which will be 2.7. And I doubt very seriously, John, if Exxon's paying 7%, Exxon's stock is going to be where it is today at 95. I mean, in the year 2000, Exxon's stock was at 40. Today it's at 95. And quite honestly, that's what has made Buffett a very wealthy man.
Well, let's zoom out from Exxon and take a wider look at the landscape and ask ourselves the question then, are there other very similar opportunities out there? I mean, given the double-digit gains we've seen over the last year or so, this looks pretty good if there are other opportunities in which you can engage.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are plenty of stocks out there. You just have to know where to look. I mean, Ralph Ancampora in the first hour talked about, you know, a number of stocks out there like Texas Instruments, Pfizer, DuPont, Microsoft, Micon International, which famed hedge fund manager David Einhorn has taken a position in, DuPont, another stock that one of the famous hedge fund managers are accumulating. And one reason I think I like dividend stocks and why we talk about them so often here on the program is they reward you immediately. If I buy a stock that doesn't pay a dividend, then I got to hope I bought that stock at the right time, my entry point was perfect, and that I have to depend on that stock to go up, somebody else to pay a higher price. The nice thing about a dividend stock, on the other hand, John, is they generate cash flow. I'm getting dividends, cashable checks I can either invest or go out and spend. And that dividend doesn't change with market hiccups. If we have a correction, we have a debt ceiling debate, a fiscal cliff debate, a Syria problem, the dividends keep coming in. And that, I think, is very important.
Let's see if we can jackhammer this just a bit, which Ari's used to explain that when you want to take something and really drive it down into the ground so that people understand it. Are there other examples that will really support this model?
Well, I'm sure. I mean, going back to the first hour today, Ralph talked about a number of stocks, but he said, you know what, to really put a lot of this in perspective is you got to look at a long-term chart, because that long-term chart gives you a more complete picture as an investor. I mean, he talked about Texas Instruments. The stock peaked at almost $100 a share in March of the year 2000. Today, it's at roughly around $42 and change. And like Walmart, so many of these Dow stocks went nowhere, John, for 13 years. And that's what you're going to pick up in a long-term chart. If you look at a monthly chart or a weekly chart, I usually like to look at monthlies first and then weeklies. And you don't see that unless you look at this long-term chart. I mean, you take a look at Texas Instrument. It had $8 billion in revenues in 2000. Today, they're somewhere around $12, $13 billion. In the year 2001, they actually lost money. We were in a recession. Today, they'll make about $2 billion. If you take a look at Texas Instruments dividend, 2.8%. That dividend has gone up 49% in 1 year. Over 3 years, it's been going up at 30% a year. Over 5 years, it's going up at 21%. So let's just be conservative and say instead of 20%, it only goes up 10%. Well, you're looking at 2.8% dividend yield becoming 7% 10 years from now. So, you know, here's an example, and I can give you that example with Walmart. I can give it to you with Coca-Cola. I can give it to you with Johnson & Johnson, United Technology. I mean, you just go right down the list of the Dow 30 stocks, and this is the story that you're going to get.
You know, you could almost view the managing of stocks like this, treating the stock like a bond. I think the difference is, though, unlike a bond, the stocks, I think the way Warren Buffett is looking at it, the stocks will go up every year.
Exactly. And that's what he's doing. It is why he remains, bar none, the most successful investor of the 20th century, the most successful investor alive today. And it's also, to his credit, why Berkshire Hathaway, as an insurance company, has outperformed every one of his peers, because a lot of insurance companies invest primarily in fixed income. In fact, the largest insurance company in the world, Allianz, brags about how much it has in fixed income and how much they've gotten rid of their stock portfolio. And it's one reason why Berkshire Hathaway is in the top 10 S&P 500 companies in terms of market value.
Okay, well, at the risk of being a party pooper here, you know, there's always that fear of another market crash, Jim. I mean, you know, you can talk about a correction next year like you're expecting, I think, but people keep looking at 2000 and 2007, 8 when there were crashes. Because people, what's really funny is people forget the crashes that are two decades old. Have you ever noticed that? They get become euphoric and they forget the early crashes, and when it's right in their recent memory, they go, oh my gosh, it could do this again. But of course, the next group will come in and forget that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always try to illustrate this point with the worst case scenario. And probably the worst case scenario I could think of any investor is, let's say it's January 1, 2000. You have $100,000 to invest and you put $10,000 in, let's say, 10 Dow stocks. And let's begin with Exxon, because that's what we've been talking about here with Buffett. In May of 2008, Exxon was selling at roughly about $95 a share, which is where it is today. In 2008, Exxon was paying 35 cents a share quarterly in the way of a dividend. In 2013, Exxon's dividend is now 63 cents a share. So during that whole period, John, despite all the things that we've experienced since 2008, Exxon's dividend is up 80%. Now the stock's at 95. So in between 2008 and 2013, you would have gotten an annual pay increase of 10% every single year. Now, let's just don't stay with Exxon. Let's go on to Walmart. Walmart stock was at $59 a share in 2008. That's when it reached its high. Today, it's at $79, and I think it's going higher. In 2008, Walmart paid, let's round it off, to about 24 cents a share quarterly. Today, Walmart pays 51 cents a quarter in dividends. That dividend is up 114%. And I can go, and I'm not going to do this, but I could take 30 stocks in the Dow, and this is kind of what Ralph Ancampora was saying, that a lot of these stocks are going to double in the next couple of years. I could tell you the same thing with Johnson & Johnson. I can tell you the same thing with McDonald's, Coca-Cola. So to me, it's one of the only sound ways to invest. And I think, John, it's going to be more important for retirees or those that are nearing retirement, and especially those pension funds. And I think that's why you're going to see more pension funds turn in this direction, because how are they going to meet future pension obligations for retiring employees when, you know, you can invest in a treasury at 2.7% and that's all you're going to get? Most of these pension assumptions are assuming 8% rate of returns. And I can tell you, you're not going to get that in the bond market. Even if you hold the bonds to maturity, the best you're going to get is 3%, maybe 4% if you push it. And I think that's what Buffett is trying to do here. He's saying, look, in this kind of market, I could put my cash, because I have to invest it as an insurance company, to earn enough return to pay out when a catastrophe occurs. So I can go in a bond or I can go in a stock. And the stocks that he's investing in are all increasing their dividends at 9 and 10% or more a year. And that's a strategy. John, I just think it makes a lot of sense. And it's just amazing that more and more people aren't picking up on this. When I got in the business, the only reason you bought a stock was for the dividend. And then we got into the crazy 90s and the 00 decade, and it was all about growth. You didn't need dividends. You didn't need sales during the dot-com bubble. And that was, you know, something I think is going to come back in vogue again here over the years as investors look at some of the alternatives.
Packaging this all up, it's a very simple concept. Warren Buffett would seem to be investing in stocks as if he were investing in bonds, but only in those companies paying dividends. That's the link here, because he knows that they will have the ability to keep paying in the future. That's the whole goal, is to keep generating income off of these dividends, just as you would generate them off of bonds. The advantage is if you buy the right stocks, the dividends will actually go up, whereas in bonds, you're stuck.
That pretty much sums it up.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
To sail on a dream, on a crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown.
As always, at the end of the week, it is time to do our report on the market's bill of health. Here's where you need some sound like that or something like that.
Take out your stethoscope.
Yeah, we should get one of the electronic ones that monitors heart rate. Things not being that great out there and occasional worries. Nevertheless, the market is ignoring that on the way to what would seem to be record territories.
Well, I mean, John, the market continues to shrug off. A lot of people have called it the Teflon market because it shrugs off of the bad news, no matter what it is, and continues to make new highs. And that's what we saw this week. This week, we saw the Dow, the S&P cross what I call several century marks, considering the S&P has gone from 1426 at the beginning of the year, and as we're doing this show right now, the S&P is at 1800, so we went through 1500, 1600, 1700, and now we're at 1800, assuming this holds up to the end of the day. I mean, that's one heck of a run. The Dow, on the other hand, is playing sort of catch-up. We started out the beginning of the year at 13104. We're now touching over 16,000, about 17 points above it. So from, if you take a look at the Dow theory point of view, both the Dow transports and the Dow industrials are now in sync. Each index is confirming the other by making new highs, which is what we did this week.
Well, maybe if we look at the little bumps that we've gone over, we had the economic slowdown, a lot of taper talk going on, debt ceiling debate, which was, I think, much ado about nothing since we knew where it was going to wind up, and the slow motion train wreck that is Obamacare. The market seems to be going up nevertheless, and that seems to fulfill the old adage that bull markets climb a wall of worry.
It really does. And as Ralph and I talked about, usually a bull market in any kind of asset has three phases. When it first begins, it's normally after a long protracted bear market or a severe bear market. Think of what happened in 2007 and 2009 when, you know, most of the markets lost almost 45% to 50%. And so when the market begins, a new bull market, there's always this sort of disbelief or dismissal because everybody's looking through the rearview mirror. And we're now running or moving into what I call the second phase of a bull market, which is acceptance. I mean, you have to take a look at the market bottom in the S&P, which was 666, and here we are talking about 1,800. So it's up almost threefold, over 150%. And I think also, bonds are now producing negative returns and are likely to do so going forward. I mean, bond investors lost money this year. If you're in a bond fund, you're negative. And this is going to be a force, I think, going forward where money, and especially on the institutional side, is going to have to choose between blue chips, let's say dividend paying stocks with solid balance sheets. And you're starting to see that, John, in what Ralph Ancampora did in hour one. He calls the next rotation as money gravitates towards the big blue chip stocks, which are starting to break out of a decade-long consolidation pattern. We've talked about this on the program quite frequently over the last couple of years, and especially this trend change really began to change last summer, when you really started to see some of these stocks that virtually went nowhere, and I'm thinking of Walmart as one of these stocks, which was basically Walmart was selling at where it was 13 years ago. And it wasn't until recently that you've seen some of these stocks break out. We'll talk about them here in just a minute. But I think that when you see these stocks break out of a long consolidation pattern, it tells you things are changing.
You know, Ralph thought that this was, signs of the next rotation. Are you actually corroborating that?
Yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time, I try to follow all the Dow 30 stocks and the S&P 100. We essentially call these the market generals. These are the largest cap stocks, whether you're looking at the big stocks in the Dow or the top 100 stocks in the S&P 500. And I mean, Ralph talked about that these stocks are selling at levels of where they were 13 years ago. A good example is DuPont. DuPont hit a high of roughly about $75 a share back in the end of 1999. The stock is selling at 61. So it's selling at below where it was, let's say 13 years ago. I can take a look at General Electric. General Electric hit a high of $60 back in the first part of 2000. General Electric is now at 27, and this stock is starting to break out. And what I like to do is what Ralph talks about. If you want to see a bigger picture, if I look at a one-year chart, daily chart, it's looking like a 45-degree pattern with these stocks breaking out as the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 22% this year. So you would expect to see that. And they've been on an upward trajectory going back to, let's say, March of 2009. But if you look at a weekly chart or if you look at a monthly chart, I like to start out with monthlies. It gives you a broader perspective of where these stocks have gone over the last 13 years. General Electric is still far below where it was selling at. Same thing with Walmart, which went nowhere until the summer of last year. Walmart was selling at almost, you know, currently it's at roughly close to $80 a share, but it was at $68 a share in the year 2000. So if you look at that, you know, Walmart's moved, what, about 10 bucks in the last year. I can look at Microsoft, where Microsoft was roughly about $53 a share back in 2000. Today, Microsoft is at around 30, a little over 37, close to $38 a share, still selling at below where it was in the year 2000. You can look at some of the phone companies like Verizon, which is selling below where it was back in 2000, not to mention the fact they've had dividend increases, dividend yields, which are better than treasuries. And John, I can go on the list. I can go with Exxon. I can go with Johnson & Johnson. And many of these Dow stocks, DuPont, as we talked about, and we're starting to see these stocks break out. We did a story about this, I think it was mid-year, when the Dow first broke through and the S&P broke through the $1,500 range, and we finally had surpassed the previous highs reached back in September of 2007 and March of 2000. There were a lot of people calling for a bubble at that time. And we took a look at the Dow 30 stocks, and we found that 60% of the Dow was selling at prices lower than where they were 13 years ago. Not to mention the fact that many of these companies have quadrupled their sales, quadrupled their dividends, quadrupled their profits. And that was basically in an inflationary period, as we saw in the last decade. These companies continue to expand sales and earnings, but what you had was PE compression. Instead of selling at 30 times earnings, as earnings went up, the stocks did not go up, so the PE multiples came down. And I think that's about to change. And that's, I think, what Ralph was referring to in the first hour.
Could you say that this is more of a reflection of the safety trade? Because as, you know, reminds you of people getting into the water, they sort of put their feet in. Very few people jump right in, and they're just trying to find safe places to go as they get back in.
In some ways, I think part of it, but I also think it's a rational reaction to the markets. And that's what makes this market rather healthy, because they're looking at, you know, if I'm a portfolio manager, I'm looking at asset classes and I'm looking at where I can get value. And if I want to go into the stock market, do I want to chase Tesla or some of the social media stocks and pay a lot of money? I mean, Tesla has been one of this year's stellar performers, but the stock's down about 40% in this correction. So if you look at these alternative choices, and I'm an institutional money manager, you know, I'm looking at it the same way that we'll be covering Buffett's bond strategy. Right now, I can go into 10-year treasuries and I can get 2.75%. Or I can go into Coca-Cola and get 2.8%, and that dividend will go up every year by 10%. I can go into Johnson & Johnson and get 2.8%. I can go into Microsoft and get a 3% dividend yield. Intel is even better. Who would have ever would have thought 13 years ago we'd be talking about dividend yields on Intel, a 3.75%. I can go into DuPont at 2.9%, Merck at 3.5%, Chevron at 3.25%. So I think if you're an institutional money manager, you're going to say, look, I can go into treasuries at 2.75% at the lowest rates they've been in over 30 years, in 10 years from now, I'm going to still be earning 2.75%. If I go into Coca-Cola at 2.8% and it's going up 10% a year, I'm going to be earning 7% 10 years from now. So I think that is why we are seeing this move into the acceptance phase of the bull market, which is the second phase. And that's the rotation I think you're going to see. The next big rotation, John, is going to be into blue chip stocks.
Given the fact that the markets are now at all-time records, as a matter of fact, what sectors seem to be working? Anything that jumps out at you?
Well, I mean, we try to break out the market in terms of industry groups, in terms of those that are performing very strong and those that are weakest. If you want to look at specific sectors, the S&P has 10 sectors. I'll get to that in a minute. But if you want to look at individual sectors, airlines are very strong right now with fuel cost and gasoline going down. It's no different. I mean, if gasoline costs have gone from, let's say, $3.80 a gallon down to $3.20 nationally or $3.25, you can imagine what that means for the airlines, their biggest cost is fuel. Airlines are doing well. Wireless telecoms services, pharmaceuticals are really starting to pick up, and diversified financial services. Think American Express. And surprisingly, John, with the aerospace and the sequester, aerospace and defense stocks have been doing real well. Now, some of the things that did well at the beginning of the year are the ones that are lagging right now. Some of the weakest sectors we're seeing is real estate investment trust, mortgage rates going up, electric utilities, diversified telecom, water utilities, and real estate management companies. Now, if you want to look at specifically what's doing well in the S&P, there's 10 sectors. What's leading at the very top of the list is consumer discretionary stocks. Number one performing sector has been healthcare, consumer discretionary, industrial stocks, and financials. So healthcare at the top, consumer discretionary next, industrial stocks, which goes along with the manufacturing renaissance, financials, especially regional banks, and now we're seeing diversified financial services, the brokerage companies. And if you think about it, with commodity prices coming down, inflation moderating, and we're in this disinflationary cycle, that means more money in consumer pocketbooks. I mean, think about it, folks. If the price of, let's say, unleaded gasoline goes from $3.80 to $3.25, and you're buying a tank of fuel every week to go to work, think of how much extra money you've got in your pocket. You're saving $15, $20 a week. And consequently, we're seeing two things do well in the consumer discretionary. We're seeing the bargain basement type companies, retailers do very well, as well as the high end, especially with stocks and real estate going up. On the bottom of the end, it's, the things that did well at the beginning of the year are lagging. Right now, it's utilities, telecoms, materials, and energy, although energy has been playing a little bit of catch-up. But if we look at the intermediate term barometer that we follow five sort of technical barometers of the market. Three of them are bullish right now, two of them are bearish. On the bullish side, we have the trend, meaning the trend of the market, which has been going up, hitting new records. We have liquidity, you know, obviously with the Fed not tapering and Janet Yellen basically saying, as Ralph called it in the first hour, this is the Janet Yellen rally when she testified before Congress saying, look, we're not about to cut back and tighten. And then another bullish trend is momentum. A lot of momentum coming into this market. You can see it across all the indexes. It's not just that all the major averages are going up and hitting new records. We've got the NASDAQ hitting close to 4,000. Who knows? In the next couple of years, we may hit 5,000 and take out the old highs reached during the tech bubble in March of 2000. We've got, I don't care if you're looking at transports, you're looking at the Russell, you're looking at the NASDAQ, you're looking at world market indexes. I mean, I can take a look at around the globe, and you always like to see this in terms of confirmation. You know, European stock markets are doing very, very well this year. It's not just our market. Of course, we're leading. I mean, the Dow Jones Euro Stock Index is up about 16%. You've got markets like the German stock market, which we watch. That's up 21%. Number one performing major market this year has been the Nikkei. It's up about 48%. But if you take the depreciation of the yen in dollar terms, the Nikkei is up about 27%. So we're seeing a lot of confirmation, not just in our markets here, but also markets around the globe.
And what would the risk to this scenario be?
I mean, we have the Fed meeting coming up December 18th. There was a little talk about, hey, maybe we ought to look at tapering coming up. So if there was a very, very strong statement that came out of the December Fed meeting, which I don't doubt, why would they want to throw gasoline onto the fire? The markets are going up. Yellen will become chairman in February. Does Bernanke really want to do what he did in May and just throw a monkey wrench into things? So taper is always an issue, John, because one of the things that this market is driven by is liquidity, and it's one of our technical barometers, and liquidity is very, very bullish. And unless liquidity becomes an issue and becomes front page news as it did in May and June, this market is heading higher. And, you know, at some point, if it keeps going, and especially if it keeps going into the new year, at some point, we're going to get a pullback. And how big that pullback, Ralph talked about, we may get our first significant correction, but this thing's got a ways to run here And I still think that we're on our way to hitting that year-end target around 1850. Some good news that can come out. The LEIs are supporting it. And we also can have some good news coming out of the Christmas Black Friday, which is next Friday. If that number looks good, that might carry us with enough momentum to get us into the end of the year to reach those target numbers of 1850.
Well, Jim, here we are. This is the last program we're doing before Thanksgiving weekend. And so we wish everybody in the United States a happy Thanksgiving. Also, Friday, when we did the show, marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Everybody I've been asking that's in the age group old enough to remember, do you remember where you were that day?
Oh, absolutely. I was in a classroom, and I can remember the principal. I was going to a private school at that time, so it was a very small classroom. And the principal walking in and letting us know. And, you know, I was a young person. Obviously, I knew who the president was. But remember, it just really struck me. It's like, given where my age was, wow, they assassinated an American president. That was such a big thing back then. Because what was the last assassination before that? Was it Garfield or
McKinley?
McKinley,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, by a guy by the name of Leon Eichhardt. His name was actually Chagall, but when you look at it written out, it looks like something you'd see on an eye chart.
Leon Eichhardt?
Yeah, because his name looks like an eye chart. You know how they ask you, can you read this line? Blah, 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 blah. Well, that's what his name looks like.
It was one of those hard-to-pronounce names. But yeah, I mean, it really struck me because growing up, last time that we had seen that happen was really in the 19th century.
Yeah, it was a distant past is really what it was. It was something that happened back then. Yeah, I was in high school, too, and Father Desmond, where was it, a Catholic high school, and Father Desmond came on. He was a principal, and he announced, first of all, that he'd been shot, and we didn't know what the status was. And then later on, they announced that he'd passed away. So then they just dismissed school for the day. And, of course, then, you know, we were all glued to the TV for, that was Friday, so we were all glued to the TV over the weekend and came home from church only to find that Oswald had been shot. So that was, it's amazing how you remember that.
That was really a tumultuous time because we were coming out of the 60s with a lot of the protest movements. Take a look at the Democratic Convention in 1968, Kent State, all the things that went on in the 70s. But, you know, a series of assassinations, not only just President Kennedy, Oswald.
Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, Bobby Kennedy, yeah. And then Martin Luther King. It was a very, very tumultuous time. And there was just a series of assassinations of high public figures at that time.
Yeah, I remember where I was when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. I was about 60 miles away. I was working at a radio station, and I remember, you know, usually back then you had these teletypes rather than like emails and things that we have today, and they would have to try to seize the trunk line coming over, and all of a sudden it would interrupt, you know, ding, 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 and L.A. would fight from New York trying to release this thing, you know, and they would usually come out with a single liner, Kennedy shot or something like that, and of course you're staring at going, what? And then you have to wait till they manage to regurgitate more news. You can't even get it on the air. You know, you had to wait until you had enough confirmation, because you'd usually just get a one or two line from Associated Press or United Press, a one or two slug line, as they would just put it through. You know, Kennedy shot, Ambassador Hotel, that's it, no details. Well, what do you do with that? You know, how do you get that on the air? And I do remember that night, because we stayed on the air all night covering events. So anyway, on that rather interesting commentary about what happened in the 60s, because it was a second turning, is what Strauss and Howe would call it, we went into in the 1960s, and then into the third turning, subsequently entering a fourth turning right now. Anyway, we hope everybody has a good Thanksgiving. Any other thoughts?
Well, I'm going sailing.
With or without the turkey?
With maybe we'll take the turkey along. That's the one nice thing about Southern California, although the day we're doing this show, we're getting, this is our rainy season for this time of the year. We get our rains from usually, November all the way into February and March, and so you never know what we're going to do, but I'm looking forward to taking some time off and actually heading out to sea. So, well, it is that time. We've run out of it, unfortunately. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend. We'll be right back.
can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.